Hey folks, welcome to today's episode of Pearls and Perspectives. I'm Dr. Amy Pearlman, board-certified urologist with expertise in sexual, hormonal, and genitourinary health. And today I have Nicoletta Heidegger, and we actually recently met at a Stimulate trade show that was this huge trade show in Nashville talking about all these amazing, innovative sexual wellness products. Nicoletta, say hello to the crew.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here. Really glad to chat with you. And it was a really fun conference.
I know, it was lovely. And, you know, we were sitting next to each other at a breakfast, and you were telling me how you work with horses to provide therapy for your patients as a sex therapist. And I absolutely love that. But before we delve into the work that you do on a day-to-day basis, I want to give our viewers a little bit of an introduction of you. And then I'll have you, if there's anything that you want to add at the end, feel free to add some nuggets. So Nicoletta is a licensed marriage and family therapist and sexologist practicing in the Los Angeles area. She received her degrees from Stanford, Pepperdine, and Widener University. And in addition to working with clients, she's currently on a hiatus of the award-nominated podcast Sluts and Scholars, a shame-free educational show designed for professionals who prioritize pleasure. And I'm going to pick Nicoletta's brain today on why urologists, all of you listening, should be listening to her podcast. Nicoletta, anything you want to add to that introduction?
No, it was awesome. My main thing is a certified sex therapist, so I'm mostly working in private practice, but I do educating and consulting and all the things around the world. So it's great to be able to sit down and chat with you, and I can't wait for what we're going to cover.
You have such a cool job. You know, when I think about...
We have a cool job.
We do have cool jobs. Like, when I think about what you and I get to do on a daily basis, why don't more people do what we do? Do they not know? Do they not know they could have a career like ours?
There's definitely more people getting into the field, which is like both exciting, but also there's so many ways to get into the field. So I think for the consumer, it can be hard to know, like, do I go to a therapist? Do I go to a coach? Do I go to this person? Do I go to this professional? But I'm glad that more people are getting into the field.
So how does one get into the field?
Again, I think it really depends like which route you want to go to. Yeah. If you want to work like directly with people, I think for people who just want to coach and kind of tell you how to have sex better, that would be more the coaching route. I would say if you're, you know, really interested in the how and why and helping people combat shame and trauma and underlying things, that would be the therapy route. I think if you're interested in the physical body and how that works and to help people like rule in and rule out physical causes. And also if you want to go to medical school, that's probably one reason people don't get into the field. Lots of school, many hours, much schooling, but worth it.
Yeah. So did you always like talking about sex?
I did. You know, when people ask me like what got me into this, I feel like it's just been my life's journey, like life goal. Place I was born, Chatsworth, California, which is like a suburb of Los Angeles, used to be the porn production capital. So I think like somehow energetically, it just, was the place for me to be born. But I've kind of always been the person who has had kind of an FU attitude in the sense that I like to talk about things and work in things that are taboo mm-hmm. and that we're not supposed to talk about. And so since I was younger, I've always asked the why questions and the wonderings. So it all kind of came together.
Mm-hmm. So often in conversations, we talk about how no one wants to talk about sex. Is that true or false?
I think they want to talk about it, but they're afraid to talk about it. You know, most of us didn't receive comprehensive sex education. In fact, right before this, I was just lecturing like 40 medical doctors at a clinic around, and even doctors don't get a lot of training, as you know, in human sexuality, unless it's your specialization. And so I think people are desperate to talk about it. I mean, so much so where in grad school, they always tell us not to tell people what we do. If you're on a long flight or an airplane or, you know, because then people at first they feel a little uncomfortable because they're like, oh, what are you going to judge the way I do things, or you're going to know, or you're going to be psychic. But then they just feel like then they have permission to start talking about anything. Like, I've had strangers crying to me in lines at Sundance Film Festival. I've had like strangers telling me like their deepest, darkest things. Like, I think people want it. They just need permission. They're afraid.
So when you're talking to 40, you know, medical providers, what are you teaching them? And what do you feel like they need to know? Like, what's their takeaway?
Oh my gosh. Well, for this one specifically, I did try to put together like all of the top things that I hear from clients, like issues that they have with their medical providers, things that they like wish their doctor had told them, and then some of the top things that I see in my practice. So today I spoke a lot about pelvic pain. And I talked a lot about, like, firstly, how to just ask questions about sex beyond the, are you sexually active? Which I'm sure you're familiar with in your specific field. But, you know, most doctors, I know they don't all have the time. They're doing so much as a primary care provider. But, you know, just only asking, are you sexually active? It's not enough. Mm-hmm. So I was teaching questions you can ask in more detail about how to get curious about the kind of sex people want to be having. Are they enjoying the sex that they're having? Not just what activities are they doing? And then I kind of spoke about busting some myths. I did some educational points around hormonal birth control and how that can impact pelvic pain, and how it's important that we tell patients and clients about potential side effects, especially sexual side effects. We talked about the importance of teaching people their anatomy and so many things that my clients don't know about their anatomy. Oh man, I could go on and on in more detail if you'd like, but mostly just things that clients come to see me for and that are, they're angry about it. They're like, they come to me and, you know, they're like, I have been struggling with this thing for so long, and why didn't somebody tell me this? And I think a lot of medical schools do a disservice by not having enough sex education. And then medical care is another place where, unless you're specializing in it, sex doesn't really get talked about.
Mm-hmm. So do you talk about anatomy with your patients? And whose role is it to talk about anatomy?
Well, for me, I would say sex is a biopsychosocial thing. And so it's so important that as practitioners, we collaborate together. Obviously, I'm not a medical professional, though I have a lot of educational pieces about medicine. So I'm there for the, you know, psychological, for the like sociosexual, for the sociocultural piece of things, but also there to give them referrals to people like you so that we can get the physical aspect of things. So my ideal would be that it's a biopsychosocial intention that we all talk about anatomy. So I definitely talk about it. You know, I don't have it here with me, but I have a vulva puppet, you know, that shows the anatomy. I have a clitoral model that shows the internal anatomy. We look at things on Google. I show them, you know, ways that different genitals look and drawings and pictures of different genitals to normalize, you know, different structures of how people's bodies look. Because most people have no idea. Like, I'm often the first person to teach somebody about like how big their clitoris actually is or like where things are. Most people have never even looked. So I absolutely teach anatomy. You know, I don't in my work, you know, see people's genitals or have them show me their genitals. That's something that, you know, a medical doctor could do and be like, hey, let's look at a mirror together and let me show you while I'm doing this exam where things are. But, you know, I show them educational resources that they can look at and compare later.
Yeah, I find those pictures and anatomical models to be absolutely priceless. I got a great like vulva and clitoris demo from Etsy.
Yeah,
it's scented. You can choose whatever color, you know, vulva you want, whatever color clitoris you want.
Like, it's so cute.
The decision I made all day was like, what color vulva and clitoris do I want?
What color did you choose?
The vulva is like bright, is like light pink, and the clitoris is bright pink, kind of like my.
That's your color.
That's my color. But when I showed this model to both men and women, their brain, their mind explodes, and they now get, when we're talking about different products that can help target those areas, yes. You know, it takes literally 10 seconds, but would take, you know, 30 minutes to explain if we didn't have a demo or a picture.
Yeah. And it's wild that you have to like go on Etsy to buy this stuff. Like, there's not a lot of like medical models that people have in their office that actually show the pleasure centers of the pelvis. And so you actually, it's readily, more readily available now. Just search 3D clitoris if you're looking to be, you know, to get something like that. But it's wild how you do have to do a little deep dive and know what you're searching for to get a comprehensive, pleasure-focused model.
Yeah, I think Etsy is the best site that I found, you know, for those demos and models. So, okay, for me as a healthcare professional, I'm always trying to figure out who should I send to see a sex therapist. So who should we send to see a sex therapist?
Everyone. I mean, I'm biased, obviously, as a therapist. I'm like, everyone could do therapy. But like I said, most sexual concerns are never just biological or physiological. They're never just psychological. They're never just one thing. And so what I have found is that, you know, when people are able to, time-wise, financial-wise, if you can get at whatever your sexual struggle is from a biopsychosocial framework, meaning a mind-body-spirit approach, your results are going to be that much better, right? For example, let's say you're working with somebody who has some like pelvic pain struggles. We could fix, I don't want to say fix, that's not a great word for it, but we could manage and have the tissue improve. You know, you can work to address and rule out the medical causes. But if someone's been experiencing pain for a period of time, their body is basically going through PTSD, like a trauma of experiencing pain. And so they might still continue to have symptoms if we're not addressing the psychological. So I would say anyone who's having physiological symptoms of sexual struggles would be a great candidate. I would say, you know, don't wait till something's quote unquote wrong. If you're able to, I think it's also a great place to just have better sex and more pleasure. So if you're somebody who wants to better understand yourself, who wants to amplify your sexual experience, who wants to learn more, come see me. I would say for people who are navigating their gender journey, you know, or sexual orientation journey and who are struggling to find community, great for those folks. If you're in a partnership and you're not enjoying the sex that you're having, come see a sex therapist. If you are struggling to have orgasms or have never had an orgasm, come see a sex therapist. If you are dealing with, you know, trauma or getting in your head or feeling anxious about sex, come see a sex therapist. But my hope is that everybody comes to see one proactively, preventatively to, you know, just like you learn to drive a car, you should learn to.
I absolutely love that message. And, you know, I say to some of my patients, you know, even if you're not having any issues and let's say you're just starting a relationship and it's great. Wow, what a wonderful time to sit down with a therapist to figure out, like, how do we best communicate? How do we keep this going? But I think the challenge is how do we as healthcare providers recommend sex therapy without giving our patients the message of us saying it's all in your head? So how might we recommend sex therapy without giving that message?
Yeah, I struggle with this comment of it's all in your head because I think even things that happen psychosomatically or quote in our head are very real. You know, we can experience them as real physiological symptoms. And so I think obviously there can be stigma and shame around mental health. I think that is changing over the years. But for physicians and things, I think it's saying what I just said, like, hey, you're spending all this money or you're, you know, using all this time to come here and work on this thing. And we have found that there's like better results when from all sides and, you know, having a therapist to like help you work through however this has affected your life can really help your outcomes. I think that that's one way to do it. I think another way is, you know, just saying like, hey, here's what I can work on here. I'm limited in this area. That's not my specialization, but here's somebody who does have that specialization and they can help take you even further or to, you know, to work on things we don't get to talk about here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think defining our roles could be very helpful. You know, so often when I'm sitting with my patients, I have a concierge practice, so I have the luxury of spending significant time with patients.
Which I wish was not a luxury. You know, I wish that was medicine.
Yeah. And so oftentimes I'm sitting down with my patients, you know, sometimes with a couple, and I'm like, I'm not a sex therapist, but I think you two would benefit from seeing someone and they're like, you are a sex therapist. I'm like, no, like I'm really not, you know, and I try to like give it a old college try. But I think one of the barriers to getting my patients in to see someone is I don't know what the end point is. You know, like when they see me, I feel like there's something that's more defined. They're coming to me for low testosterone. I see them for the initial visit. Maybe a month later, I'm checking labs. I'm seeing them 3 months later and then every 6 months, right?
And sometimes that's all they need, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes that's it.
And I guess that's the question is, could I tell someone, hey, maybe just sit down for an initial visit and then go from there? But it's not necessarily something you'd have to commit to once a week for months.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think it depends what's going on for somebody. And of course, I get that question a lot where people call in and they're like, how long is this going to take? And, you know, medical providers, you probably sometimes have somewhat more objective things of like, here's what we're going to do. And then we're going
to
do this.
Well, we're surgeons as urologists. So we like to name things.
Right. So it's a little bit less like that. And, you know, with my clients who are like that, I assure them that we do lots of check-ins as we go. But that is the tough part, right? It's like, we don't know how long this is going to take or what we're going to uncover, but you do have choice whether to be there or not. I would say, you know, obviously you have folks who come in and just you talking with them and doing your treatment, maybe that's plenty and they can go on their way. I think for folks who are continuing to have repeat struggles, then I might say, you know, hey, I don't want you to be wasting your time, energy. It seems like this has been an ongoing thing. Here's someone who can help with that ongoing piece. Or like you said, even if it is working, it's just like you said, like, hey, I'm happy to be here for you, but I am not a therapist, but I'm glad this has been therapeutic for you. You know, here's a referral. But, you know, it's unfortunate because a lot of people, I don't know if you experience this, but a lot of people reach out when things are pretty bad. At least to therapists, you know, they wait for the crisis. They wait because that's sort of like when they feel motivated to do something about it. But it's also the hardest time to actually work on things versus coming when they're feeling good and then they actually have the capacity to work on things. So it can be tough in that way. And yeah, look, you can have an initial consult with a therapist. You're not stuck. You're never stuck. You don't have to continue. And if you want to be more just sort of like results present focus, that might be where coaching is for you, of just like a handful of sessions of like, here's what you got to do, which is also an option.
Can you get a sense when you see a patient or couple in the office, who is going to be successful and who is not going to be as successful when they go through therapy?
Yeah, I mean, look, of course, such a therapist answer, but I try not to use the word like successful or not successful, just because I think success is nonlinear, right? And it's sort of like, okay, success by whose standards, right? And I think for the people who think sciencey like you, they are like, okay, well, is this going to help or not, right? Is this going to be successful or not? And I totally get that. So sometimes we have to do like processing grief work around like, how would it be to not have such tangible black and white results? And what does that look like? Because sex is not black and white, right? And I think sometimes that's when we have the trouble, is when people are looking at it in this black and white way of like, did I come or not? And the pressure on that outcome can mess things up, you know, it can cause pressure and anxiety and all these things. So in terms of quote unquote success, I guess define it as like someone who's feeling aligned with the goals that they put out there and working towards that. But we do a lot of work in my practice of like celebrating the wins as we go, not just like when you get to like, is there even a final destination when it comes to sexual wellness? Because I see it as a lifelong thing. And yes, I would say within the first few sessions, I can usually tell who's going to feel better about their journey. And it's the people who are willing to do the work in between sessions, you know, especially if we're only meeting 50 minutes, an hour, 2 hours once a week. That's enough for some people, but for many, it's just not sufficient to work on some of these bigger things. And so if they're not doing some of the resources at home, if they're not practicing, if they're not reading that book, checking out that podcast, trying this thing, looking at themselves in a mirror, you know, all this stuff, it's probably going to be slow. So it's the people who come and are like, fix me. They struggle.
So you have a lot of areas of expertise, and I have some patient sort of scenarios that I've recently encountered, and I'd love to pick your brain on some of those, if that's...
Yes. Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. So much of my practice are people coming in because they want to have more and better sex, but I have a couple of patients who are on the route of celibacy, and they ask me a lot about different chastity devices and what's sort of like a safe way to practice celibacy and a less safe way. Are there, and then when I talk to other people about it, you know, a lot of people are like, you know, gosh, like who's celibate, you know? But I feel like a lot of people are, and a lot of people are talking about it online. So what is your take on celibacy? Are a lot of people going down this route, and why might someone choose that route?
Well, are we talking about it in the kind of like kinky chosen way or in the energetic way or different, all these different ways?
You know, I think the two patients that I have, one is kind of like, I think in the energetic way.
Okay.
And the other one is he kind of goes down some rabbit holes that take up a lot of his energy when he engages in sexual acts. So he really wants to take that kind of out of his life.
Got it. Okay, so a few different people, and feel free to stop me because as a therapist, as you can tell, I can get a little long-winded because we just love to talk. So feel free to pause me. Okay, so for the folks who are abstaining from sex because they don't trust themselves to not go down rabbit holes or engage in behavior that feels out of control to them, I would say, you know, look, it's not for me to tell someone like what is healthy or unhealthy for them per se, but I do want to have a conversation with them about like what their health values are so I can help support them getting there. Granted, there may be some like objective things that are harmful or not harmful, but around folks who are doing that because they don't maybe trust their own sexuality, to me, that's a Band-Aid. Because I think a lot of people scapegoat sex and porn or other things as like the problem. And if I just abstain from that, I'll be okay. But then usually, not for everyone, but usually what I see happening is they will replace that with something else if they're not addressing the underlying thing that sex is maybe a symptom of, right? Are they having underlying depression? Are they having anxiety? Are they having relational struggles? Are they having OCD? Are they having things that they don't know how to self-regulate and are just turning to sex and it's not sufficient. So, you know, I want to get curious about like what's happening underneath so that if you do decide to take sex off the table, it really feels like an informed choice and you know that you can choose to or not choose to as opposed to just being like a dry drunk, if that makes sense. I think for the folks who are abstaining because it feels maybe like they like the energy with it, or it feels like their life force or things like that. I think there are some folks who feel that way. Again, not my place to tell them what's okay and not okay, but more to like understand what their values are and to match that. And so it's like, okay, well, is that, are you in a relationship? Is that working for your partner? How do you feel when you're abstaining? How do you alchemize that energy into other things? There are certainly times when I do think it can be helpful for folks to mindfully abstain from masturbation or porn. But again, not as just like a, let's just eliminate this and take it off the table without any other resources, but more so to help them see if the way that they're engaging with themselves is inhibiting the way that they want to have sex with other people because they've gotten so used to doing it one way. And then the last thing I'll say is that people who are being celibate for fun, kinky ways. So this looks like folks who want to wear chastity devices because they enjoy the tease and the power of not having it. And those can be really fun. So my role, I guess, would be to help them know if there are any risks, to help them find tools and gadgets that feel fun and comfortable for them and to explore things like safe words and negotiations.
Yeah, actually, on that note, I have a third patient that wore a device throughout the week with his, you know, with his wife, and he loved the tease of wearing that throughout the week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's awesome.
What's so vintage?
You never know who's out there wearing a chastity device, right? Just, you know, you could be walking down the street and someone might have what's called a cock cage on, which is a cage that goes around your penis and sometimes your balls so that you can't really get an erection and you can't touch it. And someone else has the lock and key. So, you know, next time you're out and about, just get curious. Who here is wearing a chastity device?
Oh, I love that. So I need to know, because I've had my patients ask me, what devices do you recommend? So what should I be saying? Anything that causes pain is probably a no-go. You want it to be comfortable. I mean, are there rules?
I mean, I love that they're comfortable talking to you about this, because I think that's helpful to know the medical piece of like which pain is causing some potential risks. And this is why I wish doctors knew more about things so they can at least approach sex from a safer sex perspective, right? Like maybe you don't agree with a cock cage, but you could at least say like, hey, if you wear this for a certain amount of time and it is too tight, like it could cut off, you know, some blood flow there. And like, if that's what you want to do, okay, but I need you to know the risks, right? Or like someone told me recently they had an experience where they were doing some kink play and they, the person they were playing with had undiagnosed like bone density issues and they cracked a rib.
Oh no.
And if you were able to say that to a doctor and have them know, then they could be like, hey, let's figure out what sex practices look good for your body. And, you know, this one might be riskier, but here's how you minimize risks. Or if you're okay with that risk, accept it, you know, because some people like pain and are willing to accept the risks that it can cause, you know, other things for them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so interesting. And I'm currently trying to navigate that so I can help guide my patients on different items. But a lot of it, you know, experimenting with different ones and kind of seeing what they like. But it's
I love that they're comfortable to talk to you about that. I think that's it. It's just the permission, right? To be like, hey, I don't know how this one's going to feel for you. If you start to feel X, Y, Z, that could maybe cause this. That doesn't mean you necessarily have to stop. But it is good to be aware that that could have consequences. If you accept those consequences, okay. Right? No sex is safe sex. It's just informed consent, safer sex, knowing what the risk, being risk aware.
You know, I have so many patients when I ask them, what is your method of birth control? Mm. A lot of them are like, oh, the pullout method, you know, or they're like, oh, I should get a vasectomy. You know, a lot of them are like,
yes, get a vasectomy,
you know, on what their methods are. And I find that in a lot of these circumstances, partners are not sitting down with each other to be like, hey, are you on birth control? Do you have a condom? Like, do you think I have a Mirena in? Do I have a Mirena in? Like, so many people never sit down before they have unprotected sex to ask about birth control. Uh-huh. How might you suggest that conversation should go?
I mean, first of
all, it's sexy.
Yeah. Well, firstly, it can be very sexy to have that conversation, because I personally am someone who the safer I feel, the sexier it can be. That's not true for everybody, but you know, it doesn't have to be a sit down, let's have a serious, let me look at you conversation of like unsexy. Like for me, if someone's willing to take the time to like go over what helps me feel safe and go over our like intentions and desires and status and risk factors, like that turns me on. And I think it can turn a lot of people on too. So it doesn't have to be lame. It can be flirty. It can be fun. It can be exciting. But I do want to normalize, look, most of us were not taught how to talk about sex. So people just don't know how to do it. And I think a lot of people also feel that they don't want to like ruin the mood or ruin the chances. But for me, I will say just that, you know, I will say like the safer I feel, the more sex I like to have. Would you be down to have like a little chat about all of this so that we can have more fun together?
That's sexy.
Yeah. Like, and you just say it slow, right? And look them in the eye when you say it, or have an arm on, you know, a hand on them, or like, it doesn't have to be boring. And if you want to learn how to do that talk, I really love recommending the STARS framework by Dr. Evelyn Dacher. She also has classes on it where you can like learn and practice this, but you can also just look it up online, the STARS framework. And basically it's an acronym that goes through like having an elevator pitch sexual, you know, sexual time talk. And so the first S stands for safety. The T stands for turn-ons. The A stands for avoids, like the turnoffs. R is relationship expectations, and S is STI status. Mm-hmm. And so, again, you can make it playful when you do it. Like maybe you take a walk, maybe you sit in a hot tub, maybe it's over dinner. I think there's lots of ways to have it. And that framework has been super helpful for me. And personally for me, if someone's not willing to have that talk with me, it's probably a likely chance that we won't have great sex. Mm-hmm. Because if they don't care enough to spend time on like seeing that how we can make it more pleasurable, I probably can't trust them to prioritize my pleasure. At least that's been a good litmus test for me to weed out the people who are probably not going to be great.
Yeah. You know, I feel like we don't even need to do a study on that. I think you and I both know that to be true.
Well, yeah. I personally, professionally, research-wise, it's true.
But I hear you, you know, to feel safe, you can be safe in vulnerability and really enjoy the experience, you know, so much more. I want to focus on that last S, which is STI status, mm-hmm. because I think it's an easy conversation to have if someone's STI status is negative. Yeah. I've had that conversation before where I say, look, I haven't been tested for 6 months. I think both of us should get tested, you know? Mm-hmm. And you're right. Like the guys that say, it's a pain in the butt. I'm like, okay, totally cool.
Well, then we're not having sex,
you know? And then other guys are like, okay, I'll schedule an appointment for tomorrow.
Yeah, I've already scheduled it since you told me in the last 30 seconds.
But it's easy when I can say, hey, my results are negative. Right. But Nicoletta, what if they're not negative? How do you then continue that discussion?
Yeah, look, I mean, there's obviously so much stigma in our world about STIs. And even though I'm in this field, look, I would be lying if I said I didn't experience it too, both in terms of like my own experiences and status and also when thinking about who I want to connect with and safety because of like underlying health issues. So like, I wish I could say that, you know, someone like me is even like above the stigma, but because it's everywhere, it's hard. And look, I think the fact of the matter is, if you are sexually active, you will probably get an STI. You probably already have an STI of some kind. The other facts are most of them are curable, manageable, even HIV/AIDS at this point in time. I actually have a few good podcast episodes about this on the Sluts and Scholars podcast. One I did early days called HIV Princess. And it's about somebody talking about their journey with HIV and how they date, when they disclose, a great conversation for getting info about that. And then I have two, one with Emily L. DePass and one with Courtney Brames about herpes, HSV, which oral herpes probably about, you probably, you know, have even better numbers, but 80% of the population probably has herpes, maybe 100% at this point. So, you know, chances are you'll get an STI. It's just important to know your status. And so I think where the conversation goes is, look, first you have to decide, when do I disclose this, right? When do I feel comfortable, safe enough to share this? And here's another good opportunity to meet with a sex therapist. If you have an STI that is, you know, only manageable and not totally curable, then doing some work with a sex therapist for like, how do I get some resiliency and resources and community for when somebody is not interested in continuing with me if it's positive? And again, that might be ruling out people who it's not going to work with. But I think then the conversation is about, like, how much do I know about this STI and how it's transmitted? Can I provide some limited information to this person and some resources for them to read about, like, for example, like, hey, if I have herpes, like I take, you know, Valtrex if I think I'm going to have an outbreak, or I take it preventatively. Here's how that reduces risk. Out of all the partners I've had, nobody else has, you know, gotten an outbreak from this. If you have more questions, let me know. Here's some resource. But getting to that level of confidence talking about it takes practice. And that's where a coach and community and therapist can come in. Talking about when you want to, getting clear with yourself, when do you disclose, getting support so that if someone doesn't respond well, you have people who get it, listening to resources and things like podcasts to normalize, and then figuring out, you know, risk tolerance of yourself and another person and what steps you want to take. And you may find that there's a lot of people out there who are not as worried. There's going to be both.
Well, that when you were verbalizing all the different things that you could say in response to, let's say, having HSV, that gave me goosebumps, because it was, you normalized that conversation so well. You provided some, you know, factual information and different risk assessment. And I think that's what we need to be arming our patients with, is like that 30-second talk track of what they can say to a partner. And we tell our patients, you got to tell your partner. We don't actually tell them how to do it. And I think that is so valuable.
Yeah, well, just know that there's resources out there to tell you how to do it, like some of the ones I listed, people to support you. I think the one thing I will say is, like, I'm frustrated. I'd love to hear your take on it, but I'm frustrated with our medical system for not doing comprehensive STI testing. And most of the time when someone goes to get tested, if you don't know what to ask for, they usually just test your blood and urine for the basics.
Or they'll test for gonorrhea, chlamydia. I've seen
that. Gonorrhea, chlamydia, sometimes syphilis, and HIV. That is not comprehensive. Comprehensive includes an oral swab. You can also get gonorrhea and chlamydia in your throat. There are other things that you could get there as well. HPV, which I don't think there's an FDA-approved test, but there are places that do swabs for oral HPV.
Which is like a leading cause for head and neck cancer. So it's a big deal.
Yeah. There's also herpes testing. The CDC even says, because they find that people don't report more, and because of all these other things, that, you know, they don't tell people to get tested for herpes unless they have an outbreak. And there's a lot of back and forth on, like, is that the right thing? Is that not the right thing? Because it doesn't tell you where the herpes is. I don't know if I can answer that. I think it's a personal choice, but I wish it was more included from doctors of, like, hey, this is an option that you have. Same thing with hepatitis. So, you know, if you want a comprehensive test, you have to ask for it, advocate for it, and sometimes pay out of pocket.
Yeah. And I've learned to ask my patients when I'm, let's say they're coming in with, you know, general pain, like testicular pain, as I ask them, have you been tested for STIs? But I don't just leave, you know, that at the end of the question. You know, I ask which one
for?
Tested for, where,
right.
Let me see the results. Because oftentimes it's a very limited screen, and I will do like the entire panel, even if I really don't suspect it is.
Just like, rule it out.
Let's just do the whole screen. And I'll, you know, I'll ask them how they have sex. So I'll get like the oral swabs, the rectal swabs. And actually at the Stimulate trade show, there were companies there that do at-home testing kits.
Yeah, it's so easy. You could do it at home.
Accessible and convenient. Yeah. And yeah, patients are paying out of pocket for it, but peace of mind is priceless. The most anxious people I've ever seen in my clinic are men who have had sexual encounters with people they don't know, you know, or outside of their relationship. All of a sudden, they notice something on their penis, or they have some sort of, you know, symptom in their genitals, and they are freaking out, and they need that peace of mind.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, look, I think ideally we're not testing just to use the word, oh, I'm clean, right? I think that's a word we need to stop using. Ideally, we're testing so that we know our status, we can get more information, we can learn how to share that with other people, we can learn to make choices to have whatever level of safer sex feels good for us, so that we can, you know, have informed consent. But it's still so stigmatized, and it's hard to break that. But it's happening.
What do you think it's going to take?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, there's cultural aspects. Like I said, I think more comprehensive testing, having people learn how to communicate these things, like this should be included in sex ed in high school. Who knows what will be allowed in sex ed?
Yeah.
But I think it would take some of those things.
So this is another common issue that I see with my male patients, is they have, you know, oftentimes we think about premature ejaculation as being like the most common sexual dysfunction in men. But I more so see delayed ejaculation, where guys can climax when they're masturbating, but they can't climax during penovaginal intercourse.
Yeah.
And for those guys, you know, like, I know part of the issue is that a vagina just doesn't feel the same as one's hand.
Right.
But it's interesting. I'd love your take on this. Is like, when we think about women, we've told women, most women can't orgasm via penovaginal intercourse, so get a toy, right? And then we tell men, that they need to climax in a vagina.
You don't.
But we do, like, you know, like, we don't tell them to, like, masturbate. I mean, sometimes I guess you could, they can masturbate in, you know, front of their partners, but we tell women they can't do it. And then we tell men, like, you have to do it. And I feel like they're the two extremes, right?
You're so right. They're, I mean, firstly, I think we also tell women that they should orgasm from penetration as a culture. But
yeah,
in our worlds, we know that that's being challenged. But you're absolutely right. There's still this double standard there. That, like, men, it's like, well, let's figure out how to work this, as opposed to, like, oh, it's okay that you finish yourself off. Like, what's wrong with that?
Yeah. And then we don't teach women how to climax with penile-vaginal intercourse if they want to do that. I know, like, right. Susan Bratton talks about that all the time. It's like, a lot of women, I think, and I think a lot of people think, could climax with penile-vaginal intercourse. We just didn't teach her or her partner how to do it. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think most people... only about 4 to 18% of people with vulvas, vaginas climax from penetration alone. And does that mean you can't learn to get there with, like, practice and positions and other things? Absolutely. I think people can learn that. And most folks need additional stimulation. So clitoral stimulation at the same time, nipple stimulation at the same time. But I think it's more just about willingness to, like, try things out and expand. You know, I personally used to think that I was, like, a one and done orgasm person, and that was, like, the limit, you know. And I think we have to know that we can maybe crash the glass ceiling of pleasure potential if we spend some extra time on it.
I love that. So what do you think is going on with these guys who are having difficulty?
The delay?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's what you said, right? Many things. I think first, most people aren't getting comprehensive sex ed. So if they're learning from porn, I think they're also, like, training themselves to maybe try to go for a longer time because they think that that's desired by the people they're having sex with. Spoiler alert, it's not desired by everybody. Second, what you said, so true. Most of the time I see it due to non-concordant self-pleasure and partnered sex, right? So the way that they're self-pleasuring, they have conditioned themselves to find their most reliable route to orgasm. So they're gripping in a certain way with a certain amount of force and friction. They found a hand or a toy or whatever that, like, provides it just the way they like it. And then a partner shows up, and first you have shared energy, right? You're not just thinking about yourself. You're also holding someone else in mind. That can be distracting. And then you're doing it differently. And so, of course, it's not going to happen as quickly in a different way. And again, that's when it's like, there's nothing wrong with having a most reliable route to orgasm. If it was something you wanted to shift, you may have to try self-pleasuring in different ways. Or, like you said, we could be like, hey, it's okay if that's your most reliable route. Sex with a partner can be for other things, not just coming. Right. And if you and your partner can get on the same page, I think sometimes it's also the partner's pressure, right? The partner wants to see the person come because it validates them, that I'm doing a good job, that you desire me. And so that can become problematic and cause pressure. So I think all the above are reasons that I'm seeing that. And I will usually most always refer them to somebody like you to rule in or rule out anything physiological. Whether that be, like, a spinal injury, or are they taking medication, like an SSRI that's causing them to not be as sensitive? Is there something happening with their pelvic floor and they're, like, in contraction and aren't able to release? I always want to look at the physical first to make sure we're not missing something.
Yeah. And I feel like I'm not going to say, like, crack the code on all those other things, but I definitely address all of those, like, medications with SSRIs, as you mentioned. Yeah. That's a big one.
Yeah.
But a lot of these guys are, like, otherwise, like, fairly healthy, you know? It just might take them, like, 45 minutes or an hour to climax, which, like, when they've been in relationships now for, you know, 20, 30 years, is just a lot. So I guess my question for you is...
But look, you said we normalize that for people with vaginas. So I hear we need to normalize that for every gender.
Yeah. And, like, okay, so for women, let's say with penile-vaginal intercourse and then clitoral stimulation, they can climax, right? I mean, I think that's, like, the magic. Okay, I'll tell. I'll scream that from the rooftops. That is magical, right? How do you think we can help guys replicate more of what they're doing when they're self-stimulating when they're penetrating? Are there techniques for that?
Yeah, again, I think it's like, if you're wanting to work on that in that way, I think it's like trying diverse stuff. So whether that's, okay, let me try self-pleasuring with a condom. If you're wearing condoms during sex, or like, let me try self-pleasuring with like just with less like holding pressure, right? Let me like try like having my hand a little bit looser. Let me try with like without lube. Let me try with lube. You know, trying different sort of like frictions. As you said, maybe we incorporate a toy of some kind to help add more stimulation or novel stimulation. I think those are a couple things to start with. And or, you know, if you have a supportive partner, you might also show them how you like it. If you're both accepting like, oh, I like to have sex for these other reasons, but if I'm wanting to come, we might have to shift to this, you know, at the end. And here's how you can help me. You can help me by whispering things in my ear. You can help me by kissing me. You can lend me a hand and cup my balls. Like, I think it depends what you want your approach to be.
Mm-hmm. So in those discussions, right, if someone is asking for things that they need, what's an appropriate way for someone to respond if they're not open to engaging in those activities?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think first people need to ideally try to sit with it themselves and check themselves about like, what is it about this that I'm having judgment about? And that doesn't mean that you have to be into it or that you have to say yes, but to get clear on like, okay, am I projecting that like this person shouldn't need this, or I'm judging it because I've never done that, or because I don't know how, and so I feel uncomfortable. So I do think it's, if you notice you have a reaction to someone's request, I do think it's appropriate to say, you know, I notice I'm having a like reaction. It's not a yes or no yet. Let me think about that. Mm-hmm. Like, I think I don't know yet is okay. Granted, if you're right in the middle of it, that might be hard to be like, I don't know yet. But it might be like, you know, I'm not sure about that just yet. Can we talk about this after? So we can plan for next time.
Yeah. Because I'll tell you, I see some guys who I know they would be get great responses to, yeah, to medications, let's say Viagra, Cialis, but their partners don't want the guys taking these medications, or they don't want their partners. I have one guy that loves using his erection ring, but his partner is like, no, I don't want you using the erection ring.
Well, probably because they think that it means that they aren't attracted to them, and it's their own insecurity, you know? Like, I want to know that you desire me and you crave me, yeah, and you don't have it. There's nothing getting in the way.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, not everyone, but that's often what I see. And so I think if you're saying no to something, you need to look at why that is and how you could be negatively impacting your connection.
Yeah. I think those folks would probably benefit from seeing a sex therapist as well.
Right. And look, if there's something you hear, you've done that self-work and you really are still like, no, not interested in that. You know, I like framing it as a compliment. I think first you have to figure out, like, is this a need for somebody? Like, if they don't have this relationship isn't going to work. That's important for that person to know. But if you're really a no on it, you know, I like the sandwich technique. Say the nice thing, say the hard thing, say the nice thing. So like, oh my God, it's such a turn on that you feel comfortable telling me what you like. Like, that's so hot. And, you know, I'm just not comfortable doing XYZ. Could you tell me about some of the other things you like? So maybe we could find something else that could be fun. Or do you think there's another way you could do that and I could just watch?
I love it. And when you say all those things, you're kind of like putting your hand on like your chin and it's like
you're seeing how I might say it to a partner in a sexy way. My voice totally changed straight
with these things.
Yeah, totally. I like
So
yeah, because like God, you can say it. It doesn't have to be serious. Oh, it doesn't have to be serious too, yeah, right? Like you can say it in this. You saw I leaned in, and there's like, you know, you can say it in ways like that.
I love that. What's like one myth in sexual medicine that instantly needs to be thrown out the window?
Oh my gosh, one myth in sexual medicine that needs to be instantly thrown out the window. Gosh, I feel like folks in sexual medicine like usually are the folks busting the myths like you. So I'm saying, like, I think in sex for the lay person, I think that, like, more so for the lay people, I think there's myths that need to be busted. But, like, that needing lube means that you're not interested in somebody. That, you know, you should be able to orgasm from penetration regardless of your gender. I think the normalizing of pain is unacceptable unless you're, sex should only hurt if you want it to, right? Like, we were talking about the fun pain. So doctors, most sex med specialists don't do this, but general doctors, normalizing pain, belittling pain, not believing pain, immediately needs to stop. Those are some top things that come to my mind. But I don't usually have these issues with sex med specialists.
Yeah. You know, a big thing that that I hear, like, from patients, I think a lot of people assume that, like, their wives are just never going to want to have sex again. Mm-hmm. I think that's, like, a big sort of myth is, like, once they no longer want to have sex, it's just never going to be in their lives again. I think the biggest barrier for me is getting the wives in to see me because we have solutions. And I think, I don't know this for sure because I haven't asked mm-hmm. them, but I think the women who are unwilling to see, let's say, someone like you or someone like me, I think they feel like we're going to open up Pandora's box if they do. And we're going to say to them, you need to have sex with your partner, you know, like 7 days a week. I think they're nervous about that because they're just so used to their day to day. They don't find joy in having sex anymore and they don't want do that again. And yet we now have FDA approved medications that can help so many women, but the barrier is getting them in to ask for help.
Yeah. Well, I think, I guess the important piece there is, like, teaching people about different types of desire and arousal patterns, right? So spontaneous versus responsive desire, which we could certainly get more into, erotic blueprints, which is like your love language, but for your erotic style. You know, I think that's another important myth is that there's either, like, high libido or low libido people. And that if you're, like, spontaneously interested, that, like, you know, that you are interested in sex. And if you're not thinking about it, that you're not. And so helping people understand that it's so much more complex than that. And so I think the reason a lot of people don't want to come in if they have more responsive desire is they think they have no sexual interest. But really, it's so much more. It's like, well, are you even enjoying the sex you're having? How are your hormones? Does your partner actually know how you want to be touched? Are you getting the amount of time that you need to actually get turned on? So I think the myth that because you feel disinterested, you are disinterested.
And I feel like we as healthcare providers are so bad at the libido question because we will just ask, how's your libido? And people like, oh, what maybe bite ice? We're like, yeah, I mean, it's your sex drive, you know, or you either say it's, like, low or high. I mean, that's how we document it in our note.
Yeah. So maybe that piece needs to end is, like, asking and teaching the more complicated pieces of, like, hey, I hear right now you're feeling disinterested. Did you know it's more complicated? Did you know that this and this is true? Did you know about this? Like, and for me, the question is more about, like, are you open to feeling more, or do you want to have more?
Yeah, that's what I hear from women all the time, right? They want it, they just don't want it.
Right. So that, I think that's good. It's like, okay, you want it, cool, there's stuff we can do about it. Yeah. If you're like, I don't want it and I don't care that I don't want it and I don't want to work on it, I'm like, all right, does that work for you? Then that's no problem for me. Like, is that a problem in your relationship? No? Okay. Then who cares? You don't need to be having, you know, that's not my choice. But if someone wants to want it, then there's lots we can explore.
Yeah. So I'm reading a book right now called Love Worth Making. And the...
I haven't read that.
Yeah. It's very good. And the author of the book says it when people ask him, like, what he does, he says, I'm basically an expert in really bad sex. What are some of the key reasons why so many people are having such bad sex?
Like, why is it bad, or why are they doing it if it sucks?
Like, why are so many people just having bad sex? Not like, why do they continue to have bad sex?
Yeah.
What is it about the sex that people are doing wrong that's making it so bad?
Yeah. I mean, I think first what you were saying, like, I think a lot of us tolerate not good sex because, again, we haven't been taught to talk about it, to ask these questions. Maybe we don't feel that we deserve more. Maybe we're embarrassed. Maybe we don't want to hurt our partner's feelings. You know, so many reasons why we put up with it. And as this book probably shares, you know, the more not pleasurable sex you have, you're going to stop doing it at all, you know, and probably build some resentment and feel some aversion to it. But what I would say includes quote unquote bad sex. I don't think there's anyone out there who's like good at sex or bad at sex. And usually people who tell me, like potential partners who say like I'm good at sex, I probably don't want to hook up with those people. Because to me, that means I'm doing this one size fits all thing that I think is good for everybody and I'm good at it. So to me, what makes bad sex is lack of attunement. So people not paying attention to verbal and nonverbal cues, slowing down enough to really connect with somebody and read their body and trying to connect and attune with them. Granted, of course, this can be impacted if you are neurospicy and have ADHD, autism. You know, there's ways that can show up that can make that harder. But certainly if you're aware of it, there's things that can be worked on. So lack of attunement, lack of doing, you know, the work yourself. To understand and spend time with yourself, what you like, what you want, practicing, you know, not knowing how to ask for things and not knowing how to ask for them kindly and compassionately. I would say folks who don't listen and don't want to actually hear feedback, people who have not worked on their ego, to not be able to hear feedback and say, thank you so much for telling me. As opposed to like, well, I know what I'm doing or something along those lines. To me, those are the key recipes for bad sex.
So if someone wants to learn how to be a better lover, and I see a lot of patients in my clinic, right? They have good health. They're working on their communication, but they have, I'm sure as a sex therapist, you don't tell someone they have poor technique, but as a urologist, I'm sometimes tell that my patients have poor technique, right?
Technique that doesn't work. Yeah. Technique that doesn't work for the body that you're connecting with.
Yes. But like no one is teaching them that. So I know that sex therapists you're not like hands on, right? With teaching people kind of like how to engage in these sexual experiences. So what would be that step? How do I direct my patients on how to learn how to have better sex? Like the nuts and bolts, like positioning. And, you know, how to use their hands and how to, you know, use their nuts.
Totally. Yeah. The nuts and nuts of it. So I would say I do demo stuff for people, you know, on like models and things like that to talk about technique. And of course, we all learn in different ways. So some people at some point probably do need to about it, not just talk about it. And so being able to do hands-on learning is really important. While I can't do that with my clients because of my license, there are so many ways to do that. And so one, if you are a visual learner, there are so many great tools online. One that I really like is Beducated. So if you aren't familiar with Beducated, listeners, it's kind of like the Netflix of sex and pleasure. So everything from like oral techniques, hands-on things, tantra, rope tying, like anything you can imagine. There's videos you can watch solo or with a partner. I also really like the videos by colleagues and podcasts called Pleasure Mechanics. So they have some really great videos out there to watch. I also really like OMG Yes. That focuses primarily on people with vulvas. Additionally, sex coaches as well. They may not be doing hands-on things with you, but, you know, demoing stuff, going to classes. I would say then depending on what state you are in, it's going to depend on the legality of it. But there are also somatic sex educators. So these are people who do hands-on sex education. They're also called sexological body workers. If you want to know what that looks like, you can watch Sex, Love, and Goop on Netflix and see that. But there are people you can go to solo or with a partner who will do hands-on pleasure education with you and really, really teach you. It's amazing.
Well, it's fascinating because I think so many of the patients that we see as urologists, we feel like we have to address everything and help our patients have amazing sex. And we play such a very defined minor role in that experience. And I think a lot of us just have to kind of acknowledge that and then figure out who are all the other people and what are all the other resources we can direct our patients to.
I love collaborating with other professionals. I mean, I'm relieved I don't have to do everything. And definitely, I think medical doctors and therapists, sometimes we feel that pressure of like, I'm supposed to fix this, right? You're coming here, you're spending this money, like I should be able to provide this. Sometimes it's ego too, when, you know, certain people are like, I don't want to have to tell you, I can't help you with everything. So check your ego if that's happening for you. And I think it's great to have a team approach. Like, it takes a village.
It really does. Yeah. And speaking of villages and other resources, you use horses as part of your therapy. How did that fit into your therapeutic approach?
Yeah, I think whenever I tell people I do sex therapy and equine-assisted therapy, they're a little bit confused. So just to make sure listeners know, this is not a... Nothing kinky going on in that realm that you might be thinking of. But in general, working with horses is an opportunity to engage in a relationship with a living being and work on things like boundaries, like communication strategies, like trauma, like nervous system regulation, like anxiety, like collaboration. And so there's so much overlap with sex therapy for people to get to work on that. So granted, it's not, you know, hanging out and working with a horse is not the same as having sex with a person. And it helps people in sort of a less scary, less pressured situation develop some of these internal tools and skills that we can then integrate and utilize for other intimate relationships that they have. And so it's a really cool experiential type of therapy for people to actually get to practice these ways of being in connection and in relationship with another living being that they can then apply to other relationships in their life.
Mm-hmm. That sounds really special. And as soon as I heard that you offer that type of therapy, I was very intrigued. Now, you have a podcast called Sluts and Scholars, and I freaking love that name.
Thank you.
Absolutely fabulous. And you've recorded, what, over 300 episodes at this point?
Yeah, it's been like 200 to 300 episodes over like 6 years. I've been on a longer hiatus of it. Maybe it will come back, but just working on some other projects. But there are so many episodes, something for everybody, whether you want to learn about sexual medicine. We talked about STIs, non-monogamy, kink, libido, erotic blueprints, like there's something for everybody on there, I think.
I feel like it would be difficult to shock you because I feel like you've probably heard everything, but was there anything that was discussed during one of those podcasts where you're like, oh, I haven't heard that before?
It does take a lot to shock me. And I would say, I remember the first time, not shocked, but the first time I was like, oh, I hadn't heard of that, was probably like maybe like 6 years ago on the podcast. I had Dr. Justin Lee Miller on, and he was talking about fantasies and research in his book. And he started talking about hue cows. So human cows. These are folks who want to be treated like bovine, whether that be like milked or in a barn or things around that, you know, animal pet play nature. And I just wasn't familiar with it. I wasn't surprised once it was explained, but I was like, oh, that's new. And then just the other night, I went to go see Dan Savage's Hump Film Festival. And that's usually a good place, not to be shocked, but where I'm like, I've never seen that before. So it's rare, but that's another good place for me to go because it's like I get to see, you know, they include films. And I mean, there was one person who liked having little figurines put inside of his foreskin.
Oh.
There was somebody who was playing with like animal parts that were like cut off, like from the butcher. Oh. Yeah. So maybe not for everybody, but you know, I'm constantly learning, but yeah, not usually shocked, but like a moment of like, have not seen that one yet. And it's cool to know that that can still happen sometimes for me.
Mm-hmm. So as we wrap up, what's one thing that someone could start doing today to allow them to start having better sex tomorrow?
Go to a sex therapist. Let me give you a more accessible one. I mean, if you haven't read Come As You Are and Becoming Clitorate, and you care about somebody who has a vulva, you need to do that now. I think next I would say, on an even smaller scale, in a non-sex related thing, just to practice prioritizing pleasure. See if you can start your day doing something just for pleasure for 30 seconds to a minute before you check your phone, before you check your emails, before you, you know, do stuff for your partner, for the kids, whatever. And this is with the intention of like really teaching yourself that you deserve pleasure, that you can have more pleasure, really growing that pleasure tolerance, because some people's are low. So start doing something just for you, like listen to a song, make yourself some tea, something just for pleasure at the beginning of the day.
So do you think the best time to masturbate is the beginning of the day?
No, I think everybody's different.
Yeah.
Yeah. But can be a nice way to start the day. Yeah, but for some people, just, you know, getting up late, family. Yeah. You do you.
Yeah, I love that. Where can people find you, Nicoletta?
So you can find me online or on social media. My podcast social media, which I'm not as active on, but you can contact me there. And it has my link tree as Sluts and Scholars. Or mine is Therapy with Nicoletta. You can also find me through my link tree, which is linktree.com/morepleasure, or directly on my website, nicolettavheidegger.com.
Awesome. And let's say someone is interested in working with you, or let's say a urologist, you know, watching is interested in referring a patient to you. What's the best way to make that happen?
You are welcome to reach out to me via email. In terms of consultations and collaborations, I can talk to you anywhere in the world. If you're looking for therapy, I can only work with you if you are based and living and physically in California. If you're looking for coaching, retreats, consultation, education, you can also reach me for that, and that can happen anywhere in the world.
Awesome. Nicoletta, it was so lovely having you on today for our Pearls and Perspectives episode. I learned a lot. I'm going to check out some of the resources that you mentioned, and I'm going to pass along those resources to my patients. So that's the next thing that I'm going to do to help my patients have better sex.
Thank you, Dr. Perlman.